Hello, my name is Nicholas Parsons, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews, and author interviews. I'm your host, Red Sale, and coming up in this week's show, author Jessica Taylor Bierman tells us about being a girl behind dark glasses.
If it could change one person's perception towards it, then I felt like it had been worth going through all I'd gone through.
Robert Kirkwood discovers the lengths that some people will go to raise money for RNIB Talking Books.
Please just go for it. We need more books into the library every day, every week, every month. And, you know, there's never too many people who have fundraised for us. It's a fantastic way to get involved.
Lorelei King reveals exactly what it takes to be an audiobook narrator.
It's about attention to detail and being conscious of every detail while not letting it sound like you're thinking of everything going on around.
And broadcasting legend Nicholas Parsons shares the books of his long and entertaining life.
And it's a way of life that has completely disappeared and will never return. But it was very beautiful and very lovely.
That's all coming up in today's Read On. It's not only people with sight loss who find print inaccessible. Many other conditions make reading physical copies of books impossible. My first guest, Jessica Taylor Bierman, spent years hospitalised by ME. One thing that kept her going was the hope of becoming an author. And her memoir, A Girl Behind Dark Glasses, was published earlier this year, and she joined me down the line to tell me more.
A Girl Behind Dark Glasses is a memoir of my first 4 years of living with severe ME. It was the severest in the South, and I really did suffer. I went downhill very quickly, and it takes on the approach of being just a 14-year-old girl when I first got sick, and then the journey I go on to where it comes out at the end.
And it really is striking how you go from being a bubbly, outgoing, active 14-year-old to being hospitalised and kept alive by feeding tubes. I mean, it was actually a very quick and devastating descent, wasn't it?
It was a hugely devastating descent. I mean, I was studying for GCSEs and I had the world at my hands, and then suddenly, because I didn't want to really be ill, and so I took the typical British approach, which is to keep calm, carry on, and nothing's happening, you're fine, you'll be okay. And it just got worse and worse and worse as the pressures of being in a school that's very demanding on your academia side of things, as well as all the pressures of being a teenager on top of that. And it just snowballed me, and I was trying to push and get better. That's all I knew to do, was to keep pushing and getting better that way. And no doctor could tell me how to get better, and that was the wrong way. It actually got me worse quicker, because I was pushing my body that couldn't fight it, and that led to a big decline very quickly.
I think that British stiff upper lip, and I was very struck by you saying, I don't want to look like a prat by going to the doctor because I'm feeling a little bit ill. I think that's something that resonates with a lot of people in the early stages of losing their sight as well. You don't want to trouble anybody with it. You're kind of almost living in denial. And as you say, I mean, it really boomeranged back on you horribly. One of the things that really kept you going was keeping your diary, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely. I think really we grow up knowing that you only go to doctors if you're really, really ill. But what's really, really ill, you know? And so the only way I could keep hold of what was going on was by keeping my diary, because I couldn't take in everything that was happening every day. You know, it was so, it could be so extremely different one day to another. So it was really interesting going back to the diary that had, in the formative days, had lots of different names, but it all came back to what I called it when I was in hospital, which was bug. I think it shows the decline of health a lot quicker than if you were to be writing a fiction on it, because it's quite startling to think it actually happened.
Well, it really comes across as a sort of war correspondence reportage diary, doesn't it? You are going through some pretty awful physical conditions, and the only person you can tell is your diary, is Bug. And it makes it very raw, very moving.
Thank you very much. That means a lot. I think I was honestly quite surprised by the reaction of Bug, the diary, and how it resonated with people, because I'm so used to keeping it that I didn't see what I'd been through was actually really quite harsh. I just saw it as, well, everyone goes through little bit, you know, bad things, and this was just my way of getting it out to everyone else. And it was only when I was doing the edit for the book that I realised it was actually quite difficult to read in parts to go over, because I think I had been taught to have like a filing cabinet. File all your memories in there, and all the things your brain doesn't want you to remember, it puts into that filing cabinet, and you sort it out and put it away and it's done with. Well, opening up that filing cabinet and kind of like putting everything out there was brilliant for the book, because it got an authentic way of showing what it actually is like to have the condition. But it took a toll on me physically to actually have to go through it again.
I know initially you wrote the book, the diary, for yourself, but clearly the decision to publish a book was to help other people deal with the same condition, same ME as hospitalised you, and, well, continues to blight your life.
Yeah, I mean, really the idea of writing a book came from the start as my coping mechanism. Bug wasn't always going to be in that book, but it became apparent that it needed to be quite early on. But really what struck me was there were so many people that were so severely ill with ME, and they weren't being heard. And I just wanted to try and help one life, even if it just changed one person's perspective on ME. There's such ignorance towards it that if it could change one person's perception towards it, then I felt like it had been worth going through all I'd gone through.
I thought the one thing that really came through, though, was that you started by being a fighter. You fought all the way through, and you're clearly still fighting. And I think that hope is what keeps it from being a misery or miserable memoir. There's quite a bit of humour in there as well. Slightly dark humour at times.
Yeah.
But you never say die.
No. I mean, I was always a fighter, and I didn't want the book to be a sad book. I wanted it to be a real book. And in real life, you have happy moments, you have sad moments, you have all sorts of different emotions all the time. But when you can always see some sort of light, it's important to portray it. I found that really part of my coping mechanism was to make up funny names for these characters, or imagine that they were, like, one of the characters is called Scarecrow, and she was a nightmare. That's why she was called Scarecrow. And so I had like different analogies for these people that they'd never know. So they'd never know who they were, but I know, and that makes it all the more satisfying. I want people to know that there is hope out there to have some improvements, not necessarily get fully better for all recoveries, but that you can improve. And I don't think that message is given enough.
You've employed social media to get the book published, to spread the word about it. I know It was funded by a Kickstarter campaign, which has produced a really good audiobook version.
I'm absolutely ecstatic about the audiobook version of it because it was really important to me, because even now I can't read very much, and so I rely on audiobooks. And so when I was doing it, I was sure that I needed to make sure there was an audiobook available. And my publishers, they didn't actually deal with audiobooks, so that was something that my husband and I sort of did on the sideline. And that was essential to me because I thought you couldn't really have a book that was for people with disabilities if you weren't going to include them.
That's something that resonates very much with all of us who are registered blind and have to rely on audiobooks. The more books that are made accessible to us, the better. And I think the more books about all forms of disability that are made accessible across the board helps us all understand that there are an awful lot of parallels between our various differing abilities.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really important that as people who have disabilities of all ranges, we stand together and fight together and continue on together.
It's a very thought-provoking, very moving and extremely well-written book, and I wish you all the very best of luck with it and your continuing fight against the condition. Jessica Taylor Behrman, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you ever so much, and thank you for having me on.
A Girl Behind Dark Glasses by Jessica Taylor Behrman is available now wherever you buy your books, in print, ebook, and audio, and it's narrated by Queenie James. You're listening to Read On, your weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. Still to come in this week's show, two of the biggest names in audiobooks reveal the secrets to becoming a successful narrator, and Nicholas Parsons shares the books of his life. But first...
Have you listened to a talking book that started like this?
Hello, my name's Moira G. I'm delighted to introduce this RNIB talking book, Hunting Icarus, which was written by my brother, Gordon Anthony.
That's Moira G reading the dedication to her brother Anthony's book, and we'll find out more in a moment, as I'm joined by RNIB fundraiser Angela Preston.
So I'm the Area Fundraising Manager for Community Fundraising in the east of Scotland. We encourage lots of volunteers in Scotland to fundraise for us, and that could be from bake sales to challenge events to basically anything they'd like to do. So it's about raising awareness of RNIB, but also about raising funds either for talking books or holding a tea for RNIB or getting involved in our national campaigns, Shades for Sight, or In the Dark events.
What I've heard is that when people sponsor a talking book, they get something at the end of it. They get a copy of that book.
Yeah, so they get a USB stick with their own dedication on. So anybody who fundraises for a talking book can record their own personal dedication, which is heard by the listener every time it's downloaded, which is fantastic. And I've recorded some brilliant dedications. But they also receive the first chapter and their dedication and a thank you from Julian Fellows.
And what have been some memorable fundraising activities?
Oh, I've absolutely been involved in some fantastic fundraising. So a great example of some of our community efforts. So some local towns have come together to raise funds for talking books, and that's involved lots of businesses and groups, individuals, choirs, which has been a fantastic effort. And that's happened across Scotland. I've had people who have sight loss who have wanted to give something back to RNIB. So they've been involved in their own fundraising events in their towns. They've taken part in skydives, taken part in the kilt walk. So there's been lots of different activities happening there. And one of the really memorable ones for me was Moira G, who is Gordon Anthony's sister. So Gordon lost his sight several years ago, and only after losing his sight became an author himself, and Moira decided to fundraise for talking books and actually ended up sponsoring her own brother's book, Hunting Icarus, which is now in the RNIB library.
And tell me about Peebles.
Oh, so Peebles has been really unique and something that has absolutely snowballed even beyond my wildest expectations. So Peebles is the first community to fundraise for Talking Books as a community. So dividing the £2,500 cost of a Talking Book across several businesses and groups, they initially agreed to pilot this initiative and was going to raise funds for one Talking Book. They've actually now just raised over £17,000 and have added almost 10 books into the library. And that has just absolutely, as I say, it's snowballed. It's been phenomenal. There's been local businesses, uniform groups, Costa Coffee, churches, banks. Yeah, it's just been phenomenal. And it's been an absolute pleasure for me to work with some really, really enthusiastic volunteers who actually had never had any connection with RNIB at all until we brought the initiative to the town.
And there was a cycle ride around Britain.
Yes, so Ken Reed, who has retinitis pigmentosa, wanted to mark the 30th anniversary of him being told he was losing his sight, so embarked upon a 750-mile tandem cycle across the UK. It was the very first challenge that I was certainly involved in when I came to RNIB, and it was phenomenal. We raised awareness, we met new pilots, we got involved with so many different organisations across the UK, and Ken was just an amazing ambassador for RNIB and for Talking Books.
Now, you mentioned pilots. What are those in the context of tandem biking?
So Ken had to have a sighted pilot. So on a tandem, Ken sits on the back. I believe that's called a stoker. And we had to basically recruit a sighted pilot to sit on the front of the tandem and steer Ken around the UK. So we recruited pilots from all the different areas that knew the local roads. And until Ken met them on the day of his cycle, he had never met them at all before. So he really had to put his trust in everybody that he'd recruited. So and it all worked out really, really well. He's made some lifelong friends along the way.
Now, since we're looking behind the scenes at fundraising for RNIB, do you go to the people or do the people come to you, or is it a mixture of both?
It's definitely a mix, yeah. So I'm proactively looking all the time for people who might be interested in sponsoring a Talking Book. I think Talking Books is a fantastic product because whether you're a company or an individual or a group, we can all resonate with and the enjoyment of reading books. So it's a really nice product to offer somebody. But yes, we do have people who come to us as well. So that might be somebody who has had some support, or their family have had support from RNIB, or a local business who knows about RNIB and wants to give something back to their community. So it is a real mix. And every week there's a different challenge that comes along from that. So it's a really interesting and varied role that I'm involved in.
And what about the people who support you within RNIB?
We have some great teams in RNIB. In fact, again, one of the first initiatives in the UK, which I'm really proud of, is our local policy and external affairs team took the community model and divided the cost of a Talking Book themselves, and then were involved in walking Hadrian's Wall, walking the West Highland Way, did quizzes, did lots of different things to come together to raise funds for a Talking Book. So I'm very proud of them, and they have sponsored the Purple Swamp Hen by Penelope Lively, which is now going into the library.
Now, if there's anyone listening who fancies getting involved in raising funds for RNIB, what would you say to them?
Please just go for it. We need more books into the library every day, every week, every month. And, you know, there's never too many people who fundraise for us. It's a fantastic way to get involved. It's a lovely thing to give to somebody with sight loss. Who doesn't love enjoying a new book or hearing from a new author? So I would say definitely we'll be more than happy to support you. And I look forward to dealing with anybody who'd like to record their own dedication, which again is a really fun thing to do. We've had a few bloopers and a few tries and a few different ways of recording the dedication, but some of them have actually been really personal. So to be part of even recording the dedication's a real privilege for me. And that's the end result of a huge amount of effort and fundraising from different people.
I'm in the privileged position of having access to the entire history of the RNIB Talking Books Library. And I know those dedications will last forever because there are books that were recorded in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s that still have the original dedication on them. So it's going to last a long time.
Yes, absolutely.
And for more information, head to rnib.org.uk and click Donations and Fundraising, or just search for sponsor A Talking Book. Angela, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks to Robert and to Angela Preston. For more information on how to raise money for RNIB Talking Books, call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles which readers can access on CD, on USB or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
Get all the latest news and more for people with sight loss by connecting with RNIB on Facebook and Twitter. Support us on social media for all sorts of extras. And it's a great way of networking with like-minded people. Search for RNIB on Facebook and follow us now on @RNIB. Follow us and find out more about the UK's leading sight loss charity and feel part of the RNIB family.
You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up in just a minute, broadcasting legend Nicholas Parsons reveals the books of his life. But before that, two of the most well-respected names in audiobooks have come together to write a book on the subject. Storyteller, How to Be an Audiobook Narrator is co-authored by Audible Hall of Fame narrator Lorelei King and award-winning producer Ali Muirden. It offers simple, straightforward advice for those who want to get started as narrators, as well as giving tips and techniques for those already working in the audiobook business. I'm delighted to be joined in the studio by both Lorelei and Ali. Welcome to you both. Lorelei, I was looking down through the list of books that you've recorded over the years, and it's a phenomenal number. It's over 200, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think I've recorded well over 200 books. I don't know about for the RNIB, but just in life, that's for sure.
What led you to become an audiobook narrator in the first place?
It was kind of like most things in my life, a happy accident, really. I was in the right place with the right accent. There was a guy I knew, and he had to do a book of American short stories. They were, I think, horror stories or mystery. And he wanted me to do it. He booked all this time, and it turned out I kind of had a knack for it. I was really quick. And we finished at lunchtime when he'd expected to be working the whole day. So he took me out for a really expensive lunch. And I thought, oh, this is a good job. and then it kind of went from there. But I didn't really get started in until I started reading for the RNIB. And I have to really credit them with getting me on the road to doing audiobooks on a more regular basis.
And do you remember the first book that you recorded for the Talking Book Studios?
Hey, that's a really good question. No. They all blend into one. I'm afraid I don't. But it was in the old days when it was reel-to-reel tape that they'd record on, and it was quite a different process from how it is now that everything's digital. But I don't remember the actual book. I do remember one book, Gin and Daggers, a Jessica Fletcher mystery. I hope it never sees the light of day. But that was an early one that I did.
And Ali, what led you to become an audiobook producer?
That's a bit of a similar thing with a kind of happy accident in that I worked for Macmillan, the publisher, for over 27 years. And the last probably 12 to 13 years of that, I was running their audiobook division. And that was quite stressful and it was, you know, very busy. And I quickly cottoned on that actually the fun part was in the studio. So I used to sit in on all of our recordings. mostly for a genuine reason, which was to make sure that, you know, they were going to plan, etc. But also because it was the fun bit. And why miss out on the fun bit if you've got to do all the horrible bit, you know, the meetings and the admin and the paperwork. So when I started up Creative Content with Lorelei, I thought that was what I'd be doing. I would just be running the business from our home offices. And I then started to get lots of requests from people who I knew in the industry to produce for them, because I'd picked up lots of tips watching all the different producers that we'd used over the 12 years and really learnt lots of the sort of tricks of the trade really from them. And it kind of snowballed from there really. So now I'm really busy. Most of the time I'm doing a project and I really enjoy it. I feel like I finally found my place in life. I love doing it and I don't ever get bored and I don't get cross and I don't get impatient with people. I just absolutely love doing it.
And it's true to say that the audiobook industry has never been as busy. What do you think has led to this explosion in the production of audiobooks?
Well, I would say, first and foremost, it has to be the advent of the download, which has made the huge difference. And you have to give full credit to Audible and Amazon for the work that they've put into promoting the audiobook as a format. When I took on doing audio at Macmillan, it was always treated a bit like, you know, you're patted on the head, the little kind of cottage industry within the main, you know, stream of publishing. And, you know, run along now, don't bother us with your funny little audio books. We've got better important things to do. But nowadays, it's really calling the shots, and the audio rights are as important to most publishers as any of the other rights that they would buy from an agent. So, and it is largely down to that download phenomenon, being able to make it so much easier for people to access audio and to have no problems carrying them around with them in a tiny iPod or whatever.
Yeah, I agree with Ali. I think also it fits into our lifestyles these days. People are just kind of discovering it and discovering that they can actually read by listening to books while they're doing other things that don't require their full attention. I think it's people becoming aware of it. And as Ali said, more availability, and that brought the price down as well, digital.
Lorelei, you've got one of the most well-respected and best-known voices in audiobooks.
Oh, you!
Well, it is true to say that some of the narrations that I've listened to over the last 30 years have not been so good. Was that not yours, I hasten to add? Was that the spur behind you wanting to share some of your secrets as to how to be a successful audiobook narrator?
Do you know what? Maybe. It was a number of things. I've been thinking about it for a long time. Ali and I have talked about it for a long time. But this year I was inducted into the Audible Narrator Hall of Fame, which I figure is when they're about to put you on the ice floe and push you out into the Atlantic.
Set you alive.
So I thought, okay, I'm going out to pasture. I may as well pass on what I know. But part of it, well, I'm joking, sort of. But I am at that stage of my career now where I do want to share. And I think you're right. Digital, which Ali has mentioned, has meant that a lot more people are able to record. And they have no guidance as to what could make them better narrators or people coming at it cold. It's also the question I get asked more than any other when people get in touch. How can I do what you do? How do I become a narrator? Or even people who like audio, they just want to know, how does it work? How do you do that? And the time just seemed right for us. We had a gap in our publishing schedule for Creative Content, and we thought, let's do it.
And from a narrator's point of view, what are some of the do's and don'ts?
Oh, my goodness. There are a lot of them. I think one of my main things that I'm constantly surprised by is how fast people read. They don't realize they're trying to match their eye speed, I think. And you have to read much more slowly than you think. That's one thing. The second thing is to be very aware of extraneous noises. People aren't aware that if they smack their lips like that or take a breath or move off mic when they're talking, all those little things. It's about attention to detail and being conscious of every detail while not letting it sound like you're thinking of everything going on around.
And Ali, from a producer's point of view?
My biggest bugbear is people who don't prepare properly, who you know, and it doesn't happen that often, but you do sometimes get some people who are new to it and who come in and they kind of, you know, sort of say, hey, so what are we doing today? And it's kind of that kind of, your heart sinks into your boots and you think, oh God, this is not going to be a good day. The preparation is the key. You know, you really have got to prepare it like you would for, you know, I say you wouldn't show up on the first day of rehearsal for a play or to record a TV or film and not know your lines. So why would you show up and not having read the book, not having any idea what you're going to do with your characters and all that kind of thing, really? It's just, yeah, it's my biggest bugbear.
One of the things I like most about your readings, Lorelei, is the fact that you create very different voices for women who are different ages or men who are actually sometimes I think different weights. You do heavyweight men very well and lighter weight men. And I genuinely feel like I'm listening to an entire cast of characters. How do you get those voices from the same mouth?
Well, thank you, first of all. And I do love doing big cast books, because it is really fun to create voices. In the book, I go into some detail, too much to go into here, about a technique I call layering, which is about how you build voices. Sometimes they all occur to you spontaneously. Sometimes there'll be clues in the text. But sometimes you have to build them. And it's really just being, I think, familiar with your voice. You need a certain amount of flexibility and to know what your voice can do so that you can create voices out of that. But thank you. That's a big compliment. I just
have to add that when Lorelei recorded that section in the book, myself and our sound engineer, who know her so well, we were just stunned at how awesome it was. We were just like, our jaws were on the floor. We were just, she flew through it. There wasn't one mistake through the whole section. And she moves with such grace and ease through all these different voices into these different characters. It was just incredible. It's worth the price of the book. Just listen to that bit on its own. I really would recommend it.
Okay, Els, I'm paying for lunch. Thank you.
Now, Ali, you too were narrating some of Storyteller. Was that your first time on that side of the mic?
It's not my first time on that side of the mic in terms of recording interviews or having a little bit of recording experience. Sometimes I'm an extra in some of our audio publications. But it was the first time to do it, one of our own books, definitely. And it was quite intimidating, I must admit. I did practice a lot beforehand because, like Lorelei says, you've got to sound very natural and like you're just kind of coming out with these things off the top of your head and reading it at the same time, which is very difficult to do. So it took me, a good couple of days of practicing, and it was quite interesting to be poacher turned gamekeeper for a change and to be on the other side of the mic, and also to sort of have someone else telling me, oh no, do that again because you did that wrong. And so maybe I've got a bit more sympathy now for the poor actors I'm producing most of the time.
One of the chapters in the book is how to deal with sex scenes, which, if done properly, are very effective for those of us who listen to them, but if done badly, are absolutely hilarious. How do you overcome the embarrassment, Lorelei, at some of the sex scenes that you have to read?
You just, as I say in the book, you just have to create a closed set in your mind. I think being an actor, if you're a narrator who is an actor, not all narrators are, you're kind of used to that. You just have to shut everything out and imagine you're alone, because nothing is worse than being self-conscious when you're doing a sex scene or sending it up. And I think you have to make it real. And even if you think it's too really dirty or you think it's corny or whatever, you can't let that show, because to those characters involved in that scene, it's absolutely real and you have to convey that. And I know some of the embarrassment is you're embarrassed because you're reading in front of people like your producer and your engineer. But Ali has some thoughts on that, I'm sure.
We actually don't. I don't get embarrassed anymore. I just kind of, we glide over certain words with the kind of, oh, can I hear the T in that word? And, you know, and the P in that word. No, I must admit, we've done some really quite raunchy books. And in particular, a book I did with the lovely Amelia Fox. And Amelia's got this gorgeous, like, English rose and beautiful, lovely sort of, you know, the nicest, kindest face. She's just lovely. And then to hear her reading some of this raunchy sex was so weird. It was just like, oh, let's have a cup of tea now, shall we? It's just very odd. But no, she did it brilliantly. And she, like as Lorelei says, she just was utterly sincere in the way she did it. And so she got through it. But it's quite funny sometimes, some of the words that you kind of find yourself going, oh, right.
In the old days, when I was recording at the RNIB, I do remember when I was first, because some of the stuff I was quite racy, and the young, usually engineer would have to tell you where to drop in from. As I said, it used to be reel to reel, and it was poor things. I felt so sorry because they'd have to go, could you come in after his throbbing member? And I'm like, thank you. I felt more for them than I did for myself, more embarrassed.
Which brings us smoothly on to which are the particularly memorable books that you've narrated over the years? Are there any really stick in the mind?
There are. I love the series I do. I think Janet Ivanovich, her Stephanie Plum series, really put me on the map as a narrator, and I'll always be grateful to her. I've just done book 25 of that series, and so that has a special place in my heart. There is a book that I did called The Cabinet of Wonders. I don't know if it ever did anything. It was a magical kind of fairy tale for adults. And that really does stick in my mind. And I don't know why, because it was beautiful and enchanting and not like anything I'd ever read before.
And Ali?
It's difficult for me because I do work on so many different types of books. I suppose the ones I love producing, I love producing children's books. They're always good fun and they're hard to do. People always think, oh, a picture book would be easy. But actually, you've got to make every word count on the page. But I also love doing a lot of the multi-voice productions that I've done. And in particular, the Graveyard book, which we won several awards for, including Best Production in the Audies. That was an amazing project to work on as well. But I've got loads of great authors that I've worked for. I've produced lots of authors reading their own books, and they're always amazing because, you know, they so want to get it right and they're great to work with. So they're always ones I treasure as well, yeah.
And is there a book that you would kill for to become the narrator of, Lorelei?
Yes. Geek Love by Catherine Dunn. Sadly, a version already exists. I've listened to parts of it. It's very good. But it's... And I would also like to do, when I was a child, the series I loved growing up was the Oz books, not just The Wizard of Oz, Patchwork Girl of Oz. It's a whole series. Some people don't realize that. And one day, maybe I will. Maybe I will record that. Maybe for us. Who knows? Might be public domain now. But I would say those two books.
And Ali?
Oh, that's a hard one. I would have killed to have been able to produce lots of the audios of the Georgette Heyer books because I love those. They're still books I go back to. They're the kind of books I describe as a duvet book. When you're not well and you just need something comforting and lovely to read. And Eve Ribertson I loved as well. There are so many good books out there. It's so difficult to choose.
And how do you future-proof an audiobook? How do we know that you will be the voice of Janet Aronovich in 100 years' time?
In 100 years' time? I suppose the short answer is, well, we don't know. I mean, you can't future-proof that. An author can always change a narrator mid-series if they want to. In terms of how do I know I'll be able to keep working? I think you just have to keep improving your craft. And as long as you can turn in something that's going to save your client money by being fluent, efficient, not taking too much studio or editing time, that's the best thing you can do to future-proof yourself. Keep improving your skills.
As a producer, I'm a bit of an endangered animal because, you know, so very few people are used, because I don't operate the desk either. I just do the directing, and that's quite a privilege these days. I think the biggest worry for narrators is definitely the advent of the automatic voice, which is going to revolutionise audio production in the future. But I do think it would be very sad if we don't have anybody reading stories, you know, a human voice reading stories, because, you know, it's, I say in the book that it's such a tradition for the human condition to listen to stories. We've done it through thousands of years, and I hope that we'll always want to have a voice, one of our own voices, reading to us a beautiful story to, you know, sit round the campfire at night. And also, you know, it's great sometimes when you've got somebody amazing, like, you know, a really famous reader, or not even famous, but just a fantastic narrator, sitting beside you on a long car journey. That's how you feel. They're there in the car with you, telling you a wonderful story. And I think that can't be better, certainly not with a robot.
Now, we've talked about the book a lot, Storyteller, How to Be an Audiobook Narrator. I take it it's available as an audiobook. Is it also available? Is it also available in print?
It's not available in print because it's very interactive, it's very hands-on, and there are exercises, there are demonstrations. So I think audio is its natural home and its natural format. You know, on our website, we have a list of the things we refer to in the book, so you can go and look at that, to the websites we refer to, but its natural home is audio.
Yeah. I mean, if we got a lot of requests saying, could we have it in an e-book format, there's no reason we couldn't do it. Mm. But you would miss out because of the demonstrations that Lorelei does are so good, and you have to hear them to appreciate it. But you could maybe work with the two in tandem if some people prefer to have a print version in front of them.
Yeah. As somebody who has to access their books only in audio, I think it's getting one back for the good guys,
yeah,
to
absolutely.
Have it only in audio. I think far more books should be produced just like that.
Well, it's a trend at the moment. There are books that are written only for audio that never have appeared in print.
Yeah. So how do listeners get hold of a copy?
Well, they're available from all digital download sellers like Audible, iTunes, Nook, Kobo, all of them. Again, you can go to our website, creativecontentdigital.com, and there will be a list of the vendors. On YouTube, if you go to our Creative Content channel on YouTube, I've been uploading videos of me demonstrating some techniques in the book. Yesterday, I did one about having a cold because I'm fighting a cold. And I talked about recording that. Yeah, those are fun to do. So you can check those out.
Lorelei King, Ali Muirden, thank you so much for all the pleasure that you've given me and all the other people who prefer to access their books as audiobooks over the years. And long may you continue in your great work.
Oh, thank you,
Rhea. Thanks. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
The first person narrator character needs two voices in a way. That narrator will probably engage in dialogue with other characters, as well as speaking in what we could call an inner voice or a storyteller's voice. Therefore, your voice may and probably should subtly change for each of these. Let me show you what I mean. If I couldn't trust Lane, who could I trust? I took a deep breath. You know, when my mom and dad died? Lane immediately sobered. Did you hear the difference? The dialogue is more performed, a little more extrovert, whereas the narration is more intimate. These slight differences help to keep things clear for the listener so that they know whether you're speaking from an inner or outer perspective.
Storyteller, How to Be an Audiobook Narrator is on sale wherever you download your audiobooks. And if you'd like a full list of the dozens of talking books that Lorelei has narrated for the RNIB, just go to the library website, rniblibrary.com, or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Hello, I'm John Cormack, and I've been reading these books, crikey, when I think about it, 18, 19 years now. Seems like a lifetime, man and boy. I suppose favourite books, well, Roddy Doyle comes springs to mind, all the Roddy Doyle, the Barry Town trilogy, which leap off the page and are wonderful to read. But I think one that would even surpass that is a book called The Butcher Boy by Patrick McCabe. That was his first novel, and shocked and, I must say, frightened the life out of me, and it was splendid to read.
When I was a young lad, 20 or 30 or 40 years ago, I lived in a small town where they were all after me on account of what I had done on Mrs. Nugent. I was hiding out by the river in a hole under a tangle of briars. It was a hide me and Joe made. Death to all dogs who enter here, we said. Except us, of course. You could see plenty from the inside, but no one could see you. Weeds and driftwood and everything floated downstream under the dark archway of the bridge, sailing away to Timbuktu. Good luck now, weeds, I said. And then I stuck me nose out to see what was going on. Plink. Rain, if you don't mind. But I wasn't complaining. I liked rain. The hiss of the water and the earth's so soft, bright green plants would nearly sprout beside you. This is the life, I said. I sat there, staring at a water drop on the end of a leaf. It couldn't make up its mind whether it wanted to fall or not. It didn't matter. I was in no hurry. Take your time, drop, I said. We've got all the time we want now. We've got all the time in the world.
I think it's a great service, the RNIB Talking Books. And it's also quite personal for me because my mother lost her sight in the 5 years before she died and used to get the books, which was lovely and a great comfort to her. The only slight downside with that was that she used to get my books and I used to get notes on the phone. As in, I don't like the way you did that.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
He's Britain's longest-serving broadcaster, an actor with 8 decades of appearances on stage, screen, television and radio behind him, and he's still going strong. Nicholas Parsons is one of the greatest straight men in comedy. It's a role he's played brilliantly week in, week out, for over 50 years as chairman of Just a Minute. So, without further hesitation, repetition or deviation, here are the books of Nicholas Parsons' life. Nicholas, was there a book that you read as a child or a young man that made you fall in love with reading?
I don't know whether it made me fall in love with reading, but I remember I enjoyed it so much. I can remember vividly, and it probably helped me in my reading, because being dyslexic but not knowing what it was. And that was the book by Anna Sewell called Black Beauty. And I think it's a classic of its kind, the book. I remember adoring it, and when the other horse, Ginger, his great friend, he saw him being carried away because he died. I mean, I think as a little boy, I think I cried as much as poor Black Beauty did. I have great memories of reading the book. I think it's a great children's book. It's beautifully written and very compelling.
Before I was 2 years old, a circumstance happened which I have never forgotten. It was early in the spring. There had been a little frost in the night, and a light mist still hung over the plantations and meadows. I and the other colts were feeding at the lower part of the field, when we heard, quite in the distance, what sounded like the cry of dogs. The oldest of the colts raised his head, pricked his ears, and said, "There are the hounds," and immediately cantered off, followed by the rest of us, to the upper part of the field, where we could look over the hedge and see several fields beyond. My mother and an old riding horse of our master's were also standing near, and seemed to know all about it. "They have found a hare," said my mother, "and if they come this way we shall see the hunt." And soon the dogs were all tearing down the field of young wheat next to ours. I never heard such a noise as they made. They did not bark, nor howl, nor whine, but kept on a yo-yo, ho-ho, yo-yo, ho-ho, at the top of their voices. After them came a number of men on horseback, some of them in green coats, all galloping as fast as they could. The old horse snorted and looked eagerly after them, and we young coats wanted to be galloping with them. But they were soon away into the fields lower down. Here it seemed as if they had come to a stand. The dogs left off barking and ran about every way with their noses to the ground. "They have lost the scent," said the old horse. "Perhaps the hare will get off."
Elizabeth Proud narrating Black Beauty by Anna Sewell, which is TB1713. It's also available in Braille and giant print. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
Well, there must be one or two, but one of the books I love very much, because I love his writing as well, and it's Laurie Lee, Cider with Rosie. He's a very charismatic writer because he's got a huge gift for bringing characters and a certain way of life, making it very vividly clear. And it's all built around this village in Gloucestershire, and he talks about the characters, and it's a way of life that has completely disappeared and will never return. But it was very beautiful and very lovely. And people were very trusting and supportive of each other. I mean, people are amazed when I say that there was no violence around and very little thieving. I mean, we never locked our doors at night. Probably in London they did, in the big cities. But there was a tremendous trust between people. And Laurie Lee captures the characters and the atmosphere. And he brings it to life with such emotion and so vividly. You're carried away.
I was set down from the carrier's cart at the age of 3, and there, with a sense of bewilderment and terror, my life in the village began. The June grass amongst which I stood was taller than I was, and I wept. I'd never been so close to grass before. It towered above me and all around me, each blade tattooed with tiger skins of sunlight. It was knife-edged, dark, and a wicked green, thick as a forest and alive with grasshoppers that chirped and chattered and leapt through the air like monkeys. I was lost and didn't know where to move. A tropic heat oozed up from the ground, rank with sharp odors of roots and nettles. Snow clouds of elder blossom banked in the sky, showering upon me the fumes and flakes of their sweet and giddy suffocation. High overhead ran frenzied larks, screaming as though the sky were tearing apart. For the first time in my life, I was out of sight of humans. For the first time in my life, I was alone in a world whose behavior I could neither predict nor fathom. A world of birds that squealed, of plants that stank, of insects that sprang about without warning. I was lost, and I didn't expect to be found again. I put back my head and howled, and the sun hit me smartly on the face like a bully.
Cider with Rosie by Laurie Lee is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB1241, which is narrated by Stephen Jack.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
Well, I suppose a book I'd like to share, because it's very important to my life. I do a show in the theatre about the life and work of Edward Lear, the great nonsense poet. I was invited to do the narration on a third programme opera, which a very creative man called Edwin Roxburgh composed and put together. And the BBC Variety Orchestra were recording it, and it was all based on the poems, nonsense work, of Edward Lear. And I was engaged, very flatteringly, to do the narration, which was, of course, reciting or performing a different nonsense verse to his music. Some of it was very straightforward, others was very challenging, and I had to have the orchestra leader lead me in. I mean, like the famous one, The Owl and the Pussycat, was very straightforward. It went on a very tum-de-tum basis. The owl and the pussycat went to sea in a beautiful pea-green boat. You know, that was very straightforward. But some of the other nonsense verse was much more challenging to put over. But I was so caught up in all this, I thought I must read more about him, because my father, who loved Lear, he loved all that, and Lewis Carroll as well. He used to read Alice in Wonderland to us occasionally. And so I got Lear's works out of the library, and I was captivated. Maybe there's something about me that just loves nonsense, I don't know. But it's very creative nonsense. It's the sense underlying the nonsense, which I think gets to me, which of course I think was Lear's whole purpose. And I got a book out by Vivian Noakes called The Life of a Wanderer. And it was such an amazing story, his life. So I then put together a program, How Pleasant to Know Mr. Lear, which is the opening line of a poem he wrote about himself, not one of his nonsense poems. And I do it around the country. I've done it in lots of different places, at literary festivals chiefly, and I'm still doing it. And I tell the story of his life, which is absolutely unbelievable, how that man survived. I mean, asthma and bronchitis, a weakling child. Tremendous stoicism. But not only that, epilepsy, at a time when it wasn't understood, wasn't accepted. Some people thought it was akin to madness. Every poem seems to be prompted by a different mood that I think he was in. Whether it was the pobble who has no toes, which is very sweet and a bit, you know, or the jumblies, which is one of his classic ones, or the yongi bongi bo, which is terribly sad. And I think he was suffering from unrequited love at the time, which he did. And that's what the yongi bongi bo suffered from. And of course his famous one, the dong with a luminous nose, which is his longest one. It's my love of Lear, inspired by reading Vivian Noakes's book, The Life of a Traveller.
He simply couldn't make up his mind. He longed for companionship, and she was so unlike most women he knew. She was kind and gentle. Poor little Gussie, he called her. And she was far happier sitting and talking than rushing into society. But for Lear it wasn't easy. She might refuse him, which would be distressing, or accept him, which could be worse, for he would have to tell her about his epilepsy, and then she might change her mind. Lady Jingly, Lady Jingly, sitting where the pumpkins blow, will you come and be my wife, said the Yongi Bongi Bo. I am tired of living singly on this coast so wild and shingly. I'm aweary of my life. If you'll come and be my wife, quite serene would be my life, said the Yongi Bongi Bo, said the Yongi Bongi Bo. He went to see Lady Waldegrave to ask what he should do, and she warned him that as Gussie had no money, it would be too much of an extra burden for him. He became anxious and depressed, and developed nervous symptoms of neuralgia and an itching skin. If he couldn't propose to Gussie, then he didn't want to come back to England again. There was still a year to go on his Stratford Place lease, but he had had an offer from Maclean's Gallery to exhibit his work there. He could accept this, close Stratford Place, and wander away.
Andrew Timothy narrating Edward Lear, Wanderer's Life by Vivian Noakes, which is TB 743. And Nicholas Parsons, with just a touch of hesitation, repetition and deviation, is available in Braille and giant print from the RNIB Library, where you'll also find him narrating his memoir, The Straight Man, My Life in Comedy, which is TB10187. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, complete with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or you can find producer Robert on Twitter at @talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.